At the end of the day, the American people should feel proud of their military, that we hold folks accountable.
A Coast Guard admiral speaks out on the case against a helicopter crash survivor. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Girdwood skier survives a deadly avalanche in Washington State.
All of us were experienced backcountry skiers. We felt that we were in the right place.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Rasmussen Foundation, accepting online nominations for the 2012 Distinguished Artist Award until March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
The Coast Guard Admiral in charge of Alaska has broken his public silence on charges against the survivor of a helicopter crash that killed three people from Air Station Sitka. Lieutenant Lance Leone faces charges that include the military equivalent of negligent homicide. It will be up to Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo to decide whether those charges proceed to a full court-martial, get handled administratively, or are dropped altogether. But Leone's attorney says comments Ostebo made on a Juneau radio station compromise his ability to be fair in the case. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Ostebo appeared on KJNO's Action Line program on February 10th. During the hour-long talk show, he was asked about the case against Lieutenant Lance Leone. Here's some of what he said.
I think where the American people ought to look at this, and the people that, you know, here, is this isn't a witch hunt. This isn't anything. This is a process that we go through. And at the end of the day, the American people should feel proud of their military, that we hold folks accountable, that we thoughtfully look at these things, that we provide all the rights and support for the defendant that they deserve and have earned and are legally bound to, and we follow those rules.
After the accident in July of 2010, Leone recovered from his injuries and was cleared to return to flight, pending some training. Ostebo took command of the Coast Guard's District 17 in May of 2011. Sometime between then and September, Leone's orders for training were canceled, and the charges were issued.
We came here in May, and that was something we had to deal with, and we're dealing with it the way we're supposed to. And I understand the people of Sitka. I understand the emotion involved in this, and I'm okay with that. My shoulders are big enough to handle all that.
He said the process is ongoing, and that he has 90 days from the end of a December hearing to decide whether to proceed with the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or UCMJ for short, or handle the matter administratively. News of the North, a program on KJNO's sister station, KINY, reported Ostebo's comments. They appeared to deal mostly with the procedure of the case and not his own opinions, but Leone's attorney has a different interpretation.
Very, very few commanders, in fact, I cannot remember a single commander, who would ever discuss an ongoing case with the media.
Retired Colonel John Smith is Leone's private attorney. He's practiced military law for 30 years. He says Ostebo's assessment of the judicial process left out a third option, to drop the charges entirely.
Well, it sounds to me like Admiral Ostebo has already made up his mind. He has made up his mind that Lieutenant Leone will be punished either via the UCMJ or administratively.
And Smith objects to Ostebo's statement that the Uniform Code of Military Justice is a lane that the Coast Guard is traveling down in order to investigate the crash.
The military justice system is not a lane. It is a very, very serious process that focuses on the alleged wrongdoings of an individual.
Leone's defense team maintains that their client has done nothing wrong and is only guilty of surviving the crash. Lieutenant Veronica Colbath is a spokeswoman for the Coast Guard in Alaska. She says the Coast Guard can't comment on an ongoing investigation, and that includes commenting on concerns that someone raises about the case. But she did say that Ostebo was invited on KJNO to discuss work that the Coast Guard is doing in the Arctic, and during the hour-long conversation, he was asked where things stood with the Leone case. Throughout the case, the Coast Guard has told KCAW it won't make public comments until the proceedings are settled, and Smith, on Leone's defense team, has not consented to an interview with KCAW until now. Smith says he's requested several meetings with Ostabo, but has been denied. He says Ostabo's attorneys told him that the admiral won't discuss pending litigation. If the case is sent to a court-martial, Smith says he could protest Ostabo's neutrality. Such a move could send the case to a new convening authority, which is the person who performs Ostabo's function in deciding whether to put Leone on trial. But Smith also said that he has not committed to any specific legal action.
I am intimately related and interested in taking that action which will best serve Lieutenant Leone. And in this particular case, I believe that Admiral Ostabo cannot make a fair and impartial decision.
The officer who heard evidence in the case back in December recommended that Ostabo drop the charges against Leone, but his recommendation is not binding, and Ostabo is free to pursue whatever option he deems suitable. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
The State House and Senate are both working on increasing funding to schools this year, but the lawmakers disagree over how to get there. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
House Speaker Mike Chenault from Kenai says he believes the House and Senate are close in principle over approving an increase in funding for local schools. But while the Senate has approved an increase in the base student allocation, or BSA, over the next 3 years, Chenault indicates the House is more in agreement with the governor, who opposes increasing the base amount of the appropriations. Speaker Chenault says that type of funding adds up.
Since 2004, the average daily membership cost for education, just in the general fund dollars, has went from $6,402 per kid to today averages $14,290 per kid, or a total cost of $842.7 million into 2013 at $1.8 billion.
The current BSA is only $5,680 per student. The amount of money Chenault refers to comes from the law setting up the formula. It adds extra money to that base for such things as students with special needs or for costs of providing service in various remote parts of the state. By combining money for low-cost schools, like Anchorage, with expensive schools like the Yukon Flats District, the average cost is closer to the number Chenault uses. Last year, the legislature did not raise the BSA. Instead, it provided extra funding specifically directed to covering the high costs of energy that school districts faced. The governor and proponents of a flat BSA this year say other special requirements can be met without making a commitment. But Carl Rose, the executive director of the Association of Alaska School Boards, says it all begins with the base student allocation. He says that's the linchpin for all the other calculations.
The only way you can factor these things in is through the base student allocation. If you put the money anywhere else, it's not reoccurring, and we can't function from year to year. Oh, I take that back. We will function. The buses will run, and the doors will open, and we will service our kids, but we will not be able to provide the kind of our program that, you know, that we expect from our schools.
School district leaders in the Capitol last week complained they could not make plans for next year without knowing if this year's budget will include those add-on grants, such as the energy costs of last year. The Senate bill increasing the BSA is currently in the House Finance Committee and is not now scheduled for hearings. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska residents would receive energy vouchers to help address high energy costs under a bill introduced in the state Senate. SB 203 would provide every adult recipient of an Alaska Permanent Fund dividend this fall a voucher for either 250 gallons of heating oil or an equivalent amount of natural gas or for 1,500 kilowatt hours of electricity. Senator Joe Thomas, the bill's primary sponsor, in a floor speech called for working together to solve what he called the greatest challenge facing far too many Alaska families. The bill does not yet have a fiscal note detailing the cost. A $3.7 billion surplus has been projected for this year and next, and Thomas said a goal is to use about 9 cents of every surplus dollar to provide assistance. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an antique car museum in Fairbanks showcases some vehicles that were ahead of their time.
There was an electric car, ran as long on a charge as the very best models being made in 2011, 2012.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A Girdwood skier survived an avalanche yesterday that killed three other skiers in Washington state. Elise Sogstad was swept nearly 2,000 feet down a steep slope in the backcountry near Stevens Pass. The four were among three groups of skiers, about a dozen people in all, making their way through a foot and a half of fresh snow when the avalanche hit. It has been reported that the avalanche danger was listed as high when they were skiing, but in an interview with NBC's Today show this morning, Sogstad said that wasn't true when they left in the morning.
When we went out that morning, the avalanche danger wasn't at high. And so all the signs that led up to us being there were signs that we felt comfortable and safe being there. All of us were experienced backcountry skiers. We felt that we were in the right place.
Sogstad credits an airbag inflating device with saving her life. The skiers were all well equipped with rescue gear. They rushed to dig out the victims and perform CPR on the men, but weren't able to revive them. Sogstad grew up skiing at Alyeska and racing on the Alyeska ski team. She says she intends to keep skiing despite the tragedy. For months, scientists have been on watch for a possible eruption at Mount Cleveland. Now, another Aleutian volcano is acting up, too. The Alaska Volcano Observatory issued an advisory for Kanaga Volcano after it experienced tremors and released a small ash cloud on Saturday. Kanaga lies just 16 miles west of Adak, but so far, there are no reports that this weekend's explosive activity has affected residents. The community suffered disruptions to air travel when the volcano last erupted in 1995. The aviation warning for Kanaga is at code yellow, while Cleveland remains at orange. Both volcanoes are located along major international flight paths. With oil and gas issues dominating Alaska politics, it can be easy to forget that as many as 20,000 people work in the state's commercial fishing industry every year. That's 6,000 to 7,000 more jobs than on the North Slope. So, as many fishermen near retirement age, the next generation is looking to step into leadership roles. For the last 4 years, the Alaska Young Fishermen Summit has brought together some of the brightest young minds in the industry. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more on the gathering, which took place in Juneau last week.
Anybody else in the audience like to come forward? Yes, come right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Timothy Nick, and I come from Dillingham.
Timothy Nick fidgets nervously in a blue sport coat as he addresses the House Fisheries Committee on a resolution pledging support for programs designed to boost the fishing industry. The 21-year-old got his first crew share at 15, working for his family's Bristol Bay SetNet operation, but he never intended to make a career out of fishing.
It was hard for me to watch my dad go through that hardships and not having that much profit coming out of fishing.
But when he was 18, Nick's father gave him the family permit and bought another one. Today, the father and son operations are turning a small profit. Nick says House Concurrent Resolution 18, which pledges continued support for education and loan programs for fishermen, shows that the state is committed to growing the industry.
It would be great to have that pass so that young fishermen like myself, who almost didn't go into fishing, to be able to keep the permits inside the state and amongst the local citizens who rely on fishing as a main source of income.
We're always really thrilled when we see one of our past participants writing a letter to the editor or testifying before the Board of Fisheries.
Sonny Rice is the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program agent in Petersburg. Since 2009, the University of Alaska Fairbanks program has organized the annual Young Fishermen Summit to groom the next generation for leadership roles. Rice says that's becoming more important as older fishermen get ready to retire, the so-called graying of the fleet.
Not only do you have to know all that there is about gear and fishing and running your boat safely, but you need to have a head for business. You need to have some business training to help you balance your books. You need to understand the markets for your product. And you need to know about the science and the management of your fisheries. And you need to get involved in the regulatory process.
The two-day summit features panel discussions and seminars, not only with scientists and policymakers, but also bankers, insurance agents, and economists with expertise in the fishing industry. Timothy Nick says he got tips at the conference that should help his family's fishing operation. While they only fish during the summer, Nick says the money has to last throughout the year.
Being able to make that money stretch through the winter is kind of one of the problems I deal with. Also understanding like the insurance stuff, the tax information. I've always wondered about that through the years, but this is opening me up to those like learning opportunities.
In its first 3 years, the Young Fishermen Summit was held in Anchorage. Having it in Juneau this year gave participants the added benefit of interacting with lawmakers. Lexi Fish, a 27-year-old troller and longliner from Sitka with the perfect name for a fisherman, says she's always been interested in fisheries policy and thinks the summit will give her more confidence to express herself.
Probably my biggest priority is making the resource sustainable over the long term. It has to provide for people to keep their livelihoods commercial fishing.
Rice says one of the goals of the conference is to help young fishermen find their voice.
What they have to say is important. Their individual stories make a difference, and those decision makers want to hear those stories.
After hearing from participants in the Young Fishermen Summit, the House Fisheries Committee unanimously passed House Concurrent Resolution 18. The non-binding measure appears to be headed for a vote on the House floor. About 50 young fishermen take part in the summit each year. Several seafood companies help sponsor the event. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Crews are still thawing equipment on the North Slope drilling rig that suffered a blowout last week. The Spanish company Repsol was drilling an exploratory well on Wednesday when they hit a gas pocket that caused the blowout. Natural gas was flowing uncontrolled from the well, and so workers had to shut down the equipment and evacuate the rig. Now that equipment is so thoroughly frozen, Kathy Forrester with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission says crews could be thawing it for 4 or 5 more days.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be this report for the next several days. They're thawing things out, cleaning things up, mobilizing equipment, and trying to figure out what they've got and what they can do with it.
Repsol is contracting with a company called Wild Well Control to gain control of the well. They will likely use heavy mud to do the job, but the Department of Environmental Conservation reports the line to inject mud is also frozen. Crews are working on a way to bypass the line. Forrester says even though the well is mostly quiet now, Wild Well Control will have to make sure no more gas or debris can escape.
It could be dead, or it could have a plug of some sort, just giving the appearance that it's dead. And you have to assume the worst, because you don't want to be surprised. You know, if you go in there assuming everything's rosy, then somebody gets hurt and you lose control of the well again.
Forrester says she hasn't seen a proposal from the company on exactly how they plan to kill the well, but she expects to have it in the next few days.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick, so quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Alaska's U.S. senators told a well-attended public meeting in Fairbanks over the weekend they doubt an Air Force estimate that moving a fighter jet squadron from Eielson to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson will save $32 million. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich question Air Force leaders' assumptions and will work to convince them to reconsider.
Begich and Murkowski told Saturday's gathering that they and Congressman Don Young believe Air Force brass didn't have all the facts when they proposed moving the F-16s from Eielson.
We are pushing our military on this to show us the numbers, show us your math, show us that this really works.
The senators and their staffs have met with Air Force leadership several times since the service announced the cutbacks on February 3rd. Begich said he and Murkowski got another chance Saturday morning when they met with the Air Force's top uniformed leader, Chief of Staff General Norton Schwartz, who'd flown in to visit Eielson and talk with the senators and local leaders in Fairbanks.
We were very pointed on trying to figure out why is this occurring, what's the savings, which really weren't defined, in my opinion. What are the steps? What's the procedure? How are you going to engage the community?
Schwartz told the senators that the Air Force will continue holding red flag training exercises two or three times a year out of Eielson, and that the Alaska Air National Guard's 168th Air Refueling Wing will remain at the base. He also said that the Air Force will send a survey team next month to Anchorage and Fairbanks to take a closer look at the proposal to move the F-16s. Murkowski has sponsored legislation that Begich has also signed on to that would prohibit the Air Force from spending money on moving the F-16s. It may or may not gain much support, but it's just one step in what the senators acknowledge will be a long uphill fight to halt the move. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
February weather will go down in the record books in stark contrast to January. Above normal warmth so far this month following January's extreme cold is hard to pin on any one factor. But National Weather Service lead forecaster Rick Toman in Fairbanks says the cooling of equatorial Pacific waters called La Nina likely figures into it.
These big shifts, both extreme warm and extreme cold, do seem to be somewhat more prevalent in interior Alaska during these La Nina winters. During El Nino winters, we seem to be a more steady state, somewhat above normal. But these big shifts, like we've had, do seem to occur somewhat more frequently during these La Nina winters.
Toman says last winter was also La Nina and featured some ups and downs, including two late-season blizzards in the interior. Toman says atmospheric conditions affecting Alaska since the start of this month are keeping the interior and other parts of the state warm.
Low pressure has moved a bit farther southwest, more centered over the southern Bering Sea and farther west. So that's allowed more southerly flow from lower latitudes to come into Alaska. And we've had at times that's actually developed a nice high pressure over the Yukon territory. So southeast winds aloft, that's allowing temperatures to respond accordingly.
Toman says long-range models show interior weather shifting back more toward normal, but increasing sunlight limits how cold it can get this time of year. He adds it's also the driest part of the year, and there's no major snow in the current outlook. The Fountainhead Antique Auto Museum in Fairbanks is a unique attraction in a frontier town better known for riverboats and snow machines. As KUAC volunteer producer Robert Hannon reports, the Carr Museum's elegant collection provides a rich window into the birth and development of an American passion.
It's no secret, Americans love cars. We celebrate them in song. Cadillac, Cadillac, long and dark, shiny and black. We give them star turns in movies like Bullet. We even send them soaring.
Pretty chitty bang bang, chitty chitty bang bang, we love you.
Of course, long before the growling V8s or flights of fancy, the American car represented progress and ingenuity. That in part is clear from the collection on display at the Fountainhead Antique Auto Museum in Fairbanks. With nearly 80 models gleaming in a spacious showroom, the collection follows the automobile's explosive birth and evolution. Museum manager Willie Vinton explains the collection focuses on a short 40-year period. It allows the museum to showcase the engineering and design creativity brought to bear as manufacturers responded to an ever-expanding marketplace.
If you have a car that has a one-cylinder engine, they shake and vibrate terribly.
And as they started building multiple cylinder engines, they were trying to improve on the quality of the car and try to get cars to where they were more than a toy.
Even today, Vinton says, the collection is more than a plaything. The museum's owner, Tim Cerny, wants to tell a story. And he succeeds, says Kes Woodward, a painter and art historian. He says the collection captures almost every major design introduction in the early automobile.
It's one of the ingenious things about this collection. We looked at one car that basically ran on purely on the fumes from the gas. There were steam-powered models, and there was an electric car ran as long on a charge as the very best models being made in 2011, 2012.
Woodward also likes the context the museum provides. Mounted on the walls hang huge historic photographs. They show early autos coping with Alaska, with the mud, the snow, and the rutted and makeshift roads that served the territory some 100 years ago. Also placed around the showroom are displays of vintage gowns and fashion wear dating from the same periods as the cars. They suggest a growing dialogue between fashion designers and those minds shaping the contours of the evolving automobile. That dialogue intrigues author Frank Sos. He's written about cars and how they inform ideas of beauty in the American imagination. He says, in every generation, many boys and young men first engage notions of line and color, form and function, by considering automobiles.
There's a suggestion that if you're an art critic, you tend to imprint on the art that impresses you first. And so I think that may be true. For my dad, it was those cars, and for me, it was probably the cars of the 50s.
So says, by carefully tailoring its collection and providing an historical context, the Fountainhead Antique Auto Museum is more than eye candy for car buffs. It celebrates an integral part of our American culture. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Dan Bross and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.